Good morning. Welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on February 18, 2025. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Sonoma County PD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, Vice President, Commissioner Julieta Altamirano Crosby, Secretary, Donna Harlow, CEO General Manager, Paul McMurray, Acting Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phone or other electronic devices at this time. Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy's clerk's table near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
I have none.
Okay. Comments from the public is item one on the agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and person shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up cards located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial star 9 if by phone. I will call on you to speak at the appropriate time. If you call in on a phone, you will need to mute star 6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name to indicate where you are from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents or the materials to enter into the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk, who will distribute those to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So at this time, I will say the flag salute and we greatly appreciate the flag.
Of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, a nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, first up, we have items. We have comments from the public agenda, item one. We have Mr. Willie Russell speaking with us. Good morning, sir. You 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Willie.
Excuse me.
My name is Willie Russell. I'm the 21st Legislative District Cascade Precinct PCO for the past 8 years. I'm here today not wanting to be here. Some things have happened in your building that caused great consternation and possible lawsuits down the line. First of all, though, I want to thank PUD for helping the people in our area be able to lock up their fencing. And you guys have a double lock. Great idea. You need to push that. People need to lock up their stuff and they don't want to give keys out to people they don't know. So appreciate the double lock system you folks have for our constituents out there. Secondly, I want to thank the supervisors of your business office and your security firm for taking care of a very serious problem 6 years later. 6 years later, we're still having to deal with the nonsense that occurred in this building. I want to thank them personally, Scott and Carrie, I believe it is, business office person. I want to thank them for that. Now I'm going to tell you what's going on. We were assaulted in your building here. They went to court, they lied, and 6 years later, they're still lying. I've been accused of shooting children in a camp to silence me about the work that the Hand Up Project has been doing in our community for the past 12 years. They're stealing over $8 million of our money. I'm complaining about it because it's happening mostly in our district. I've been accused of shooting children. Nobody knows who that is. All sorts, assaults, everything. I've even been accused of crimes when I've been out of the country. Well, here we are again, 6 years later, accused of a crime right here in your building. Nobody investigated, but 6 years later, I'm spending another $15,000 to defend myself. I'm tired. I'm tired and I'm mad. So, I'm here today to ask you, and this is from political parties. I'm a Democrat, and I'm sad to say that. I'm sad to say that. Been a Democrat my whole life. I fought in the Vietnam War to protect the United States Constitution, and we can't protect it in this county. My wife has been beat up, broken hand, based upon a lie that cost this county money. My first wife was killed, murdered, right here in Everett by a detective and got away with it. Shoved her against the wall, bullying himself into our home, and got away with it. Well, we're not getting away with it anymore. The Democratic Party is involved in criminal activity. They have supported Robert Smiley and the Hand Up Project. I have proof. I've submitted it. The FBI is investigating. They know something's wrong up here in this county. Now, the good news is since I've been a PCO, I live out by Mariner. Highly crime area. Our 18-block area hasn't had a crime in 5 years. Because we are responsible citizens that went out and made contact with the community. And you know what? They will be at my house 4th of July. We have a party. Last year, 1,000 people came to a dead-end street.
Mr. Russell, please address the commission.
I am addressing the commission. I want the people to understand the truth also. So what I'm asking you folks to do is please quit allowing the Democratic Party or even the Republican Party to rent rooms so that they can continually harass people for years. And it's happened. And they've got proof of it. Your own security's got proof. They just provided us with documents that is really going to stun on public disclosure, really going to stun this community when they're released. And I'm not here to go after anybody. I'm asking you folks to investigate this and please stop these people from renting these rooms and making up stories. Making up stories in your building that get people hurt. Hurt. We're tired of it. So please, do something for the people. Now, my organization is Ha Rouge, and so you know.
Mr. Russell, that's your 5 minutes. I'll give you another 20 minutes to finish your thought if you'd like.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Not seeing any hands up online. So move to item two, the consent agenda. 2A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of February 4th, 2025. 2B, bid award for professional service contracts and amendments. 2C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. And 2D, consideration of an amendment to contractor pre-qualifications of bidders for electric line work for the district during 2025. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
First, I'll ask if there are any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda. If there is, please raise your hand. Don't see any hands up in the room or online. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments about the consent agenda?
I don't. Can you give me 30 seconds?
Sure. Okay. Then I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carried unanimously. Next, item three, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This item is for the board and general manager to discuss issues among ourselves with PUD staff. Morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. First, I'd like to introduce our new COO, Amy Carstens. She is celebrating her 1 week anniversary. I wasn't here to help her yesterday or last week, but Mark Fleury had kind of shepherded her, and I understand he put her right in the heat of battle with some large group meetings, but she's off and running and headed into her second week.
Oh.
Glad to be here.
Corral by fire. Huh? Good.
It was like 200 people or so it wasn't.
Well, I'm impressed with your background.
Thank you.
So look forward to working with you.
Likewise.
Next up is our legislative update and Ryan Collins.
Good morning, commissioners. For the record, I'm Ryan Collins, the District State Government Relations and External Affairs Specialist 3, and I am here to present on our key legislation report covering the first 5 weeks of the 2025 legislative session. The purpose of this presentation is to report on key state legislation for the commission. I've left time at the end of this presentation as well, but please feel free to jump in with any questions you might have. So today, February 18th, marks day 37 of a 105-day legislative session, putting us just over one-third of the way through. It's hard to believe, but as of today, over 1,800 bills have been introduced. Government Relations has reviewed each of these bills and identified approximately 250 that are important enough to continue to monitor. Of these, 9 have been marked for key legislation. Since my last report, 3 new bills have been added to this list. Importantly, this is likely to be the high watermark for the number of bills that report to commission this year. That's because this Friday, February 21st, the legislature will reach the policy committee cutoff, the deadline for policy bills to be voted out of their respective committees. After this Friday, we'll see the number of bill introductions drop significantly, and we'll have a good sense of what the total pool of bills we're going to be looking at for the rest of the session is. As shown on slide 3 here, several key bills have already passed Friday's cutoff. HB 1253 is the furthest along already in the policy committee of the opposite chamber. HB 1329 and HB 1522 are awaiting floor votes, while HB 1610 has also passed the policy cutoff. HB 1804 and HB 1847, that's a lot of numbers in the same way, are both expected to pass out of their committees this afternoon. We will continue to track these bills through Friday, and we'll quickly pivot to the next anticipated cutoff, which is a week from Friday, when all these proposals must be through their fiscal committees. Given the challenges I'm sure you're reading about in the news on the budget, the fiscal cutoff is going to be pretty interesting to watch. I'm certainly going to be grabbing my popcorn for starting this weekend to really get into the nitty-gritty aspects of fiscal policy.
So what exactly does that fiscal cutoff represent?
So in the fiscal cutoff is when bills have to pass through their fiscal committees. So in the process, they traditionally go through their policy committee. So a lot of these bills are going through House Energy and Environment. If they carry a fiscal note, that means they go to House Appropriations Committee, which will then hold a hearing and also vote on the bill going forward. And so if it doesn't accomplish both those two steps in the fiscal committee before cutoff of next Friday, then it's considered quote unquote dead. No problem.
I don't want to go into an extended conversation on this, but getting to the fiscal part of the issue, you noted that the state already has a deficit. And I've just been thinking that the discussions on the budget might have additional pressure from pushing some programs back to the states. Do you anticipate?
Yes, I'll say in every single conversation I've had with lawmakers this year, the budget has come up, and that's both from the uncertainty that's currently happening at the federal level, as well as the expected revenue challenges that the state is facing here. And they're really having to make these for the first time for a lot of these lawmakers, first time to kind of have to decide what the priorities are when it comes to spending money. So.
It only exacerbates.
Correct.
So I have a follow-up, Commissioner Tony, her comment. So I'm really concerned about that too, because, well, number one, there are a lot of things happens in the federal at this moment. So and I have a question, and how will the BPA's recent workforce reduction impact or will impact our power supply and reliability and infrastructure and everything? So, and I have a lot of questions regarding a few bills too. I'm sorry that I didn't send that before.
Not a problem. I will certainly turn this over to Kim. That is, I think, the question of the day is what's going to be going on with BPA. Yeah.
Hey there, Kim Johnston. I'm the Chief Government Relations Officer here at the PUD. It's a great question. As we saw a flurry of news on Friday and over the weekend, BPA saw the same cuts with probationary staff that we've seen across a lot of agencies. And there were a number of folks within BPA that opted to take the buyout, the opportunity to receive some pay without working. They're trying to reduce the full workforce at the government level. We also saw news today and late yesterday that they're reevaluating some of those and looking to hire some of the staff that they had previously let go back on. So I think everything, you're going to hear this a lot from me over the next 6 to 8 weeks. Everything is still in flux. We don't know the impacts. There will be a lot of meetings. I have meetings on my calendar later today to really understand the impacts. Once we have a better understanding, we'll be talking about that more. We're taking a trip back to DC, and this will definitely be the top of the agenda of what we talk about with our federal delegation. Thank you.
Yeah, given the role of BPA, there's lots of conversations happening. I think everybody's very more. Any other questions on fiscal? If not, I'll jump to the next slide. So before I jump into kind of the details of this bill, I did want to address one of the commission's requests on co-sponsors and prime sponsors. We've added those at the top of the slide here. So you've got your prime sponsor up there and then a link to the co-sponsors for all of them, since some of the lists can be pretty long. But wanted to make sure that commission knows that is available now. On to our first bill, which is SB 5088 and its House Companion 1702. Both bills authorize counties to impose a privilege tax of up to 3% on a utility's gross income derived within a county's unincorporated areas. As drafted, this bill would allow Snohomish and Island counties to apply this tax to all customers within their boundaries and then also provide a tax credit to cover all the residents in incorporated cities who already pay a similar tax. This impacts the commission's local control by adding costs to consumers that are outside the control of the commission. The House version is scheduled for a public hearing this Friday, but I want to caveat that without being voted out of that committee by the end of Friday, it seems that it will not pass the policy cutoff. That said, I do again want to have a second caveat there, is that bills like 1702, which do carry a fiscal impact, can be considered under like necessary to implement the budget. So while it is most likely to not pass the policy cutoff, there is the opportunity for them to revive it later in session.
It has moved very far along.
It has not moved far along. All that being said is that we're going to continue to monitor this.
I have a lot of questions regarding this bill. Mm-hmm. First of all, I would like to know, or if you know, and it's not enough against you as the information, and it's how will the revenue generate from this public utility tax be allocated and distributed? So that is something that all the counties, we cannot generalize. Every county is different. So I'm concerned a little bit about this because it's how will be impact or how they're going to affect the cost of utility services for consumers and our counties too as well.
It's a great question. I don't know off the top of my head what the county would plan on spending this on. As you mentioned, every county is different. So I think there's flexibility in the statute to kind of allow them to spend it on what they see as necessary. So I think we're still waiting to see. That said, it is a pass-through tax, so that it is expected that the utility would again create a separate line item on customers' bills that would include whether it's 1%, 2%, or 3% related to this tax on their bill, so they know where it's coming from.
And last but not least, I would like to ask our representatives how familiar are with each county before they bring those bills. And I know there is good intentions, but wondering also what relationships they have. I mean, close relationships with all the PUDs around, because it's easy to be in an Olympia and the disconnection is a lot by witness and experience and being a city council in Lynwood. And there are a lot of bills that impact, and we have a full house in the city. They think they connect or at least reach out the city council's elected officials, but they didn't. So that's the reason I'm really concerned about this, because it's, we recently increased, you know, the percent in the utilities, and having these tax is how going to impact in our community. And I really concerned about that. So, and I respect every single legislator, but it's like how well, I mean, that they come into the meetings, that they reach out, I have no idea. So I don't criticize that, but I think the money is really important, but how they are going to, it's going to work. So I don't know.
I completely agree. Communication is paramount. And I think particularly on this issue, we've been advocating for exactly that, the affordability concerns that this potentially would cause. We're only seeing upward pressure in prices. And so this, again, would just be another thing that our customers would have to deal with. I will also note we have been in conversations with Snohomish County as well as the cities related to this. And I think we're very much aligned in some of those concerns or those in our perspectives.
But I do agree with Commissioner Altamirano Crosby that it's a very good observation that it's unfortunate on the state and the national level that bills or legislation that's discussed is, I don't know where it came from, but there clearly is oftentimes no interaction with those that it affects. And I'm speaking to utility industry, or the water industry, or whatever. It's most unfortunate. I'm done.
I'm just amazed they don't have the taxing authority now, since the cities can tax up to 6%.
It has been one of the arguments that have been going back and forth of the cities have a, they already have the ability to do this. The counties, again, are, everybody's looking for revenue options. And this was, again, I think something that counties have, some counties said, well,
be greater than instead of all the three,
right? Just streamline them or standardize them.
Yeah.
Then the one?
All the three. The cities can do six now. So I get a 6% goes to the city of Arlington.
Okay.
And I would guess most cities are probably at the max.
I would assume that's a good question.
But it's just fascinating. The counties haven't had the tax either for three. Mm-hmm. So.
Never a dull moment. On to our next bill, which is HB 1253, which clarifies and expands how consumer-owned utilities may engage in joint use or limited liability company agreements. The bill adds language to the current statute, which would allow Washington utilities to engage in agreements with non-Washington regulated entities, which is mostly applicable to out-of-state electricity generation agreements. Introduced at the request of Seattle City Light, the bill received a 90-6 vote on the House floor and is now headed over to the Senate. This bill very much looks like it's on a glide path towards passage later this year.
And with this bill, I have only a comment. And how will the impact local utilities and their ability to plan for future energy needs?
This bill should allow us to have more flexibility when we go out with RFPs to find new generation sources. So it should benefit the PUD in any of those conversations.
Okay. So is this the public-private one?
So this would just, the PUD has a lot of ability to engage in certain types of contract with generation. Yeah. This just expands. There were some uncertainties in the language when it came to PPAs with non-Washington regulated entities that are non-utilities outside of the state. And so this just allows those contracts to be applicable to those types of entities.
And I'm naive, but I'm curious. So that this bill ensures that community and environmental concerns are fully addressed.
So it doesn't change any aspects of community engagement or environmental assessments thus far. Again, it would just clarify language for these types of agreements.
Thank you.
No problem.
I'm sorry, I did my homework.
Oh, no, it's great. I love the questions. Yeah. Please keep them coming.
I was into it and I have more, okay?
Yeah, please do.
I'm so happy to email you everything because I don't want to.
No, this is, I like this being a little bit more of a Socratic back and forth.
Sorry.
So please not around the ropes since then.
Yeah.
I have a lot of questions with the people in Olympia all the time. It's like, sorry.
There's a lot going on, and so I totally understand. So next up is HB 1237, which would modify the approval process of the Energy Facility Site and Evaluation Council. As a reminder, also known as EFSEC, EFSEC oversees the siting, permitting, and compliance of environmental laws for major energy facilities in the state. This bill aims to streamline the approval process and bind site decisions with certain criteria when certain criteria are met. The bill received a public hearing in both chambers earlier in the session, but has not been scheduled to vote out of the policy committees as of this reporting, which probably means it's not going to pass by the policy cutoff on Friday. We'll continue to check in to see if there's any movement ahead of Friday, but barring unforeseen legislative action, this bill is likely to be removed from the key legislation report going forward.
Was this bill born out of the contentious East Side project?
I think a little bit. So Representative Fitzgibbon is the majority leader in the House. He's had several bills that have been looking at kind of streamlining the siting and permitting of major clean energy projects. I think given some of the stuff that's been happening at Force Haven, which did go through the EFSEC process,
right.
It'd be hard to ignore that as some of the motivation behind this. That said, he's been doing several iterations of this. So I don't think it's the sole reason. No problem. Next up is HB 1329, which clarifies the energy purchase under long-term contracts with the Bonneville Power Administration is excluded from the no-coal provision of the Clean Energy Transformation Act, also known as CETA. This bill is a priority for the power generation pool, which the PUD is a member. It ensures that BPA's long-term preference contracts will not violate the no-coal provisions, focusing on how to categorize unspecified power brought into the state under contracts that are longer than 1 month. For a little bit more context, the Clean Energy Transformation Act is a primary climate law for the electric utility and has three major provisions. The 80-20% target by 2035, the 100% clean target by 2045, and then the no-coal provision, which goes into effect later this year. There's concern that under the current language for the no-coal provision, that it's too uncertain regarding BPA's long-term preference customer contracts. That's because long-term preference contracts include unspecified power where the exact source of the generation can't be determined. The unspecified power within these contracts combined with the length of the contract being more than 1 month means they could potentially run afoul of CETA's no-coal provisions, potentially leading to the significant financial penalties that the law carries for the electric utility. This bill would amend the statute and ensure that those long-term preference contracts are excluded from being coal-fired resources unless they are explicitly specified to include coal. The Senate bill received a public hearing in its policy committee on the Senate side last week, while the House bill is actually sitting on the floor waiting a vote. I did want to mention on this bill to really focus in on the House bill because we believe that's going to be the vehicle moving forward for this policy. Given that context, I did want to mention that the next cutoff for this, since it's already sitting on the House floor, isn't until March 12th. So we got some time, a couple more weeks for this to keep moving forward.
And I have two comments or questions. Curious how this bill interacts with federal policies on grid reliability.
Again, this is our BPA has been involved in the conversations around this bill, and I think they would agree that this would make their contracts more less likely to run afoul of those concerns here in Washington. So that should help the liability, at least from our end, but it doesn't actually impact BPA's system.
Okay. And for the perspective for the PUD, does this bill provide flexibility for utilities like Snohomish PUD to adapt to future federal regulations on wholesale market transactions?
Yes, it should. That again, we're supporting this bill because it provides us more flexibility and ensures, again, that we're not going to be running into penalties that for energy we purchase that doesn't include coal.
Thank you.
Great. Well, other questions? Keep them coming, please. Next up is HB 1522 and its Senate counterpart SB 5430, which creates a process for investor-owned utilities, also known as IOUs, to submit their state-mandated wildfire mitigation plans to the Utilities and Transportation Commission for approval. Under current laws, starting last year in 2024, all Washington's electric utilities must develop wildfire mitigation plans and review, revise, and adopt those plans every 3 years. These plans are also submitted to the Department of Natural Resources and the Utility Wildfire Prevention Advisory Committee. As you may recall from last year, the commission approved the PUD's wildfire mitigation plan last October. This bill, which only impacts IOUs, would also allow those utilities to file their wildfire mitigation plans with the UTC, who would then approve, reject, or approve with conditions those plans. Since I last reported, the bill was amended to make plan submission mandatory for IOUs, adds public workshop requirements for the UTC, and changes the timeline that the bill for the approval process of these plans from 60 days to 120 days. Since the bill only applies to IOUs, the PUD is neutral on the policy, but we're going to continue to monitor it given the increasing interest in wildfire policy here out west.
So the investor owns must have, the plans are approved by the UTC. And I thought I heard you say that for publics, privates, there's no approval process.
So in the statute now, we are required to adopt or develop and create a wildfire mitigation plan and adopt one. There was no clarification for IOUs that they needed to have the same. And so this would mandate them.
But does the state need to approve our plan?
The states do not need to approve any public. No, this again only applies to IOUs.
And does the bill require utilities to engage with local emergency management?
Yes. So under statute, we are required to engage with our local fire districts and other emergency management entities when we draft and develop our wildfire mitigation plans. Next is
Commissioner Logan. Didn't you have a question?
No.
Oh, I excuse me.
I just must look puzzled, but I don't have a question.
Next is SHB 1610 and its Senate counterpart SB 5582, which creates an exemption in the Public Records Act for critical infrastructure information. This bill was requested by the Department of Commerce. The bill defines critical infrastructure information to include details that could be used to threaten or compromise the PUD's physical or virtual infrastructure. Largely non-controversial, the House bill was amended this past week to expand the exemption to all state and local agencies, which would explicitly cover the PUD. As you probably imagine, we are supportive of this bill, and it is currently sitting on the House floor awaiting a vote.
I have a comment only for that, and I know I'm fully support this, but I want to make ensure that utilities, that this bill ensure that utilities can still protect against cyber attacks and physical threats. So that's very normal and common, unfortunately. So
correct. There's obviously been increasing concerns over the physical infrastructure, but this bill, a lot of the motivations prior to the introduction of this bill were specifically on kind of the cyber side and making sure that the statute is updated to reflect the 21st century that we're living in.
Thank you.
No problem. Next. Next is a bill that is new to our key legislation report, HB 1804, and its Senate counterpart, SB 5634, which would modify the existing Washington State University Community Solar Extension Program. The current WSU program, which was established in 2021, provides incentive payments to community solar projects benefiting low-income communities. For your reference, the PUD South Everett project was a beneficiary of these funds. The bill would modify the existing Washington State University Community Solar Program by increasing the size of project eligibility for the program, expanding who can be an administrator, adding certain labor requirements, and allowing half of the funds to be accessed by non-utility projects before the project is completed. The PUD and several other utilities believe these changes would build upon the success of the existing program. It would make program funds more accessible, resulting in additional projects being built in Washington State. Importantly, the bill maintains the current definition of community solar, which has enabled the PUD to use the WSU program for its current projects, which partner with a single low-income service provider instead of setting up a subscriber service for customers. The House bill is scheduled for a vote out of its policy committee this week.
Thank you.
Next is HB 1847, which amended the requirements under the Clean Energy Transformation Act to require specific targets for distributed energy priorities, or DEPs, and community solar projects, and requires utilities with more than 25,000 customers to establish and achieve annual targets. As drafted, the bill would mandate a 10% distributed energy resource target under CETA, and utilities would be required to meet this target or face financial penalties. The bill also requires state agencies to identify property for developing distributed energy resources and authorizes the Department of Commerce to initiate plans to develop those sites. It comes as little surprise that the PUD staff has concerns with how this bill would change our resource planning and mandates new targets that may be difficult to meet. As currently drafted, the PUD could meet all current requirements under law and still pay penalties for not having enough distributed energy resources contributing to our energy mix. The bill received a public hearing on February 10th, where the PUD submitted comments highlighting our concerns with the proposal. With a deep breath there, we are anticipating a lot of changes to this specific proposal. In fact, an amendment just dropped this morning that removes a lot of the problematic language that we saw. That said, we're going to continue to monitor this bill as it moves forward and engage lawmakers to ensure that the legislation reflects the best resource planning practices that utilities currently undertake and remove the challenging targets that would make complying with CETA difficult.
Does this bill apply to both the IOUs and publics?
It would apply to all utilities that are regulated by the Clean Energy Transformation Act, so yes.
It's frustrating to get the CETA. We have the target, we have the plan in mind, and then to say, well, you've got to do it this way. You've got to, the members of the legislature understand that
We have local control,
and it sort of feels like Lucy and the football, or Charlie Brown and the football. The football gets moved again.
You would be in good company with a lot of the other testifiers in front of the committee. I think the motivation for this bill comes from the sponsor's interest in ensuring that there's additional like residential solar and other renewables on every space on the west side of the Cascades. And so I think that's where they're coming from. I think they recognize this is more of a concept and that they are mandating additional targets on a law that is still yet to be implemented in a lot of ways. So yes, I think they recognize the concerns. And again, I haven't had a chance to go through the amendment itself, but it seems that a lot of those concerns heard.
So this one hasn't hit the policy cutoff.
It has not yet, although
you expect it to survive.
I do expect it to at least make it past its policy committee cutoff. It's expected to be exact this afternoon. That's either this afternoon or tomorrow morning. Not to say get your popcorn out for the fiscal committee, but it'll be interesting to see what the fiscal note is on this, because it will be, I'm assuming it's going to be large. Since it's mandating a lot of state agencies to do work they don't currently do. And so that, again, given the budget constraints that the state is facing, this may run into a challenge there.
10% is a big number.
10% is a big number.
From this commissioner, it better not be.
We are closely monitoring this one. This one is one that has raised several
Express.
Yeah, I have a comment, but because I saw in Capitol Press in February 13, the representative W mentioned that she doesn't expect it passed this year, but anticipates further discussions between this session and 2026. So I believe it's not going to move forward if already is in the press.
I,
so.
So the Representative Dolio, when she introduced this bill, really did start off by saying this is a conversation starter. We want to take it seriously as these things can get legs on their own. That said, I think what has been reported in the press is pretty accurate.
Can we invite the legislators to carry all these bills and look at it, the PUD and how it works here? Maybe they don't know. I don't know. It's a question. So.
I didn't understand that.
Sorry for my eyes.
I think your question is, can we have a one-on-one with them? I think that's why we have
We have lots of one-on-one with these legislators. We try to bring them up to the microgrid's a perfect example of ensuring that again, they get educated.
Report over there. I cannot even imagine. I will not survive over there.
We are an important voice for a lot of the legislators. They are listening to several other advocacy groups and constituencies as well. And so I don't envy their job in terms of trying to balance these competing priorities. That said, I'm biased, and I think we're not here to give them anything that they don't already know. So
yeah, it's just concerning. I mean, I can just imagine all one of those press reference customers that are 25,000 or now have to do this. I mean, I understand the IOUs and I understand incentivizing. That makes a lot of sense to require this.
Exactly. There are multiple pathways forward that wouldn't necessarily be as draconian its application as this.
You're
alert. I'll go off on a rant, so I have nothing to say.
All right. Last but not least is 1903. The bill would establish a statewide low-income energy assistance program within the Department of Commerce funded by the Climate Commitment Act auction revenue. For context, the Department of Commerce, at the request of the legislature, conducted a series of workshops to study the feasibility of a statewide energy assistance program, which the PUD participated in. The department published its findings in a final report last year and included specific recommendations for programs. This bill is based off the recommendations that come from that report. The bill would authorize Commerce to establish a statewide energy assistance program and would allow the utilities regulated under the Clean Energy Transformation Act to continue to either comply with the specific targets, energy assistance targets under the Act, or to participate in this statewide low-income energy assistance program as an alternative compliance pathway. We are still reviewing this proposal to understand its impact on our operations, particularly with how this program could work in concert with our current programs. The bill received a public hearing, but is not slated for executive session as of this week. Again, the caveat here is, even if it doesn't make it past cutoff, this bill could continue to be discussed because it does carry a fiscal note, which again could mean it's exempted from legislative deadline. So we'll continue to monitor.
If this bill passes, how is it going to be funded?
The bill stipulates that the funding would come from the Climate Commitment Act, but would, as of now, that's where the fiscal committees would come in and say X amount of dollars would be appropriated for this program going forward. And if it's not appropriated, then it's null and void.
You know, since you mentioned the Climate Commitment Act, is there any chance that revenues from that are going to be used to offset cuts in the state budget?
I think there are proposals to move those dollars to different areas of the budget. I don't think they have a ton of legs because I think there's enough concern from, I think there's enough proponents for the CCA funding to continue to go where it's going that it would be hard to move it to other areas. And with that, any other questions?
Any questions?
All right.
Thank you, Ryan. Great report. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your hard work.
Thank you, Ryan. Great job. Great. Next up is an update on our strategic plan. Laura Lemke. Laura.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioner. I want to thank you for having me here this quarter. I'm going to try to use the microphone appropriately. Let's get past this one. The purpose today is our semi-annual update presentation on the strategic plan implementation and execution. You got a written report at the end of Q3. It would have been in your November meeting packet. I also want to spend a few minutes this morning just making sure that we all have a shared understanding of what the strategic plan is and how we got here and what it means for us as a utility. So the next two slides are a little bit of review. I also sent a document in advance. So this is intended mostly as an overview of that information and an opportunity for you to ask questions. So our strategic plan covers us from 2023 to 2027. And we started the development of this in 2020, if you recall, literally the commission meeting before we all went home for COVID, and we started the response. We set it aside and we picked it back up at the end of 2020 and started back with our work in 2021. We started that work in 2021 with interviews with the commission and all of the existing executive leadership team members to try to establish clarity for us. So the slide that's up right now is the clarity that we worked on in the first 6 months of developing our work. And the intent of this was to ensure that as we were making decisions about what our strategic plan was going to include and the priorities we were going to set, to ensure that we all had a shared understanding and agreement about what our core purpose was in our community, what our values were, what our vision is for success in the future, and our kind of the standard and foundational elements of our strategy. And so as that came together, our purpose as articulated through that process is that we deliver essential utility services to help our communities thrive. Our vision for what we aspire to be and where we're going is to be the utility that delights our customers and energizes life in our communities. You'll hear that often referred to by John shorthand that we'd be so good at what we do that they'd choose us even if they didn't have to. We also, I think the original version of this said that we wanted to be so good at what we did that our customers would rave about us in good ways, like rave to their friends and family that they were lucky to have us as their utility. The third element that is really more strategic than anything else is our commitment. We originally articulated these as our anchors, saying that they were the things that we would always do as part of being successful. And we articulated those as being a powerful partner, providing exceptional value, delivering excellent customer experiences, and being the best version of Team PUD. And then finally, under our values, we wanted to make it very clear about what are our core values, so the things that we hold every employee accountable to all of the time. Foundational, like pay-to-play values. What are our core values and what are our aspirational values? And so our values are that every day we safeguard what matters, putting employee and community safety first. We have integrity. We are a team. We serve with pride and rise to challenges. We choose to include all, seek growth, and be bold. And I know Commissioner Olson and Commissioner Logan were part of that work in 2021. Just checking in to see if you have any questions. From there, we launched into what we called our 2040 scenario planning. And so we originally started this project by calling it our vision for 2040. We pulled a small team together. This was the beginning of having a core strategy team and then expanding it to a scenario planning team. And through the course of 2021, we ran a series of workshops where we first developed our scenarios and then we lived in those futures. And so I won't walk you through all of the details, but I do want to note that these are different than the integrated resource planning scenarios that I know you just had an update from on the power supply team. Through this scenario planning process, we don't choose a likely future and then build a plan for it. We instead evaluate all of the scenarios and identify the strategic capabilities that would be required for success across most or all of them. And then we focus on those for developing our strategic plan.
You know, I just want to say, I think that's one of the most powerful things about this plan is that we looked at multiple possibilities and thought of our plan around this.
It was part of one of the most fun parts of doing it,
yeah,
too.
It separates from many others. It's microphone they're sensitive.
Thank you. We had a good time doing it. We were just starting conversations now about how to do it again in the future.
That's a lot of tough work.
From there, coming out of the strategic plan, we had identified a series of opportunities and threats that we saw either as the most important that we had to deal with because they arose in a single scenario, but we couldn't not pay attention to them, or they arose across multiples. We also, we took all of that coalesced work from the scenario planning and we combined it with information and insight we've gotten from the commission and the executive leadership team to summarize it down into these, I don't know the count, but I think there are 12 critical opportunities and threats here. And we aligned these with our vision for what was happening with the future. And we decided that we would focus on addressing these as part of our strategic plan. From there, through a series of conversations and the strategic planning team, who I should have remembered to give credit to at the beginning of this, that included John Heath and Lisa Honeywell, Kelly Stickney, Brian Booth, who's no longer with the utility, and Sarah Vaughn, and Kim Johnson. And so together we took all of that input and we worked with the strategic, with the executive leadership team to identify our five strategic future, or strategic priorities, which are the most important areas of focus for the future. And we held a workshop with the commission to confirm that they aligned with their view and the input that we had heard from that. So our five strategic priorities are to bolster operational reliability and resiliency, enhance and involve customer experiences, actively help our communities thrive, build a sustainable future with our communities, and create the culture and capabilities needed for the future. We originally hadn't numbered them, but as we got into this, we realized that numbering them, it was a shorthand for how to talk about them. The strategic plan structure that we then identified through those conversations and were working toward was that each strategic priority would be supported by one or more strategic objectives. In the end, our strategic priorities have anywhere between 2 and 4 underneath them. There's a total of 15 strategic objectives that are numbered 1.1 through 5.3. And underneath each one of those strategic objectives, there is a series of strategic initiatives. The strategic initiatives, I'll talk a bit more about how we developed those. They came out of conversations and they are intended not necessarily to dictate the work that we do, but instead to guide us in terms of the activities and work that we need to get done. As a quick reference, those are the 15 strategic objectives underneath our 5 strategic priorities. There will not be a quiz on them later.
Here we have the solution key. Right?
Excellent.
That's cheating.
Yeah, you can ask questions.
Once we'd identified with the executive leadership team what the strategic objectives underneath our strategic priorities were, we wanted to validate that. And so at the direction of the executive leadership team, we identified a group of subject matter experts for each one of those objectives, and we brought them in to a series of workshops. They were fun and exciting in a lot of ways. One of them being, it was the first time we'd really done any big room planning in that way. Also, we were just returning to the office more fully from COVID. And so it was an opportunity for us to all get together in person, which was always fun. We did those workshops as a series of 2 meetings. And the first one, we did your kind of standard SWOT analysis, where we looked at the strengths and weaknesses of ourselves and the external opportunities and threats specific to that objective. And then we asked our objective teams to generate all of the ideas about how we could achieve the objective before they recommended what they thought we should do to achieve it. We did those workshops. There were 30 of them total over the course of July through September 2022. In the end, it was about 67-68 hours of workshop time just in the room, not counting all the time outside of the room, doing the preparation and the summary of it. We had a total of 122 subject matter experts from across the district that participated in at least one, and some of them participated in 4 or 5, for which they got huge bonus points and appreciation. And we took those 225 flip chart pages with a whole lot of voting stickers on them and summarize that into the recommended strategic initiatives for our strategic plan. That is the total of what I have for the background. I'll just pause and see if there's any questions.
I don't have questions, but I can see all the work that you did is amazing. So how you guys put together all this and the hours and the subjects and everything. So yeah, thank you.
With a lot of work by a lot of people.
I should know this, but where does the customers, the cost to the, where's the financial stuff, which block?
In terms of how we're controlling costs?
Well, we have strategic priorities, and there's all of these objectives. Where would like affordable power, and where is that in?
So it lives in two places in our strategic plan. And so the first place it lives is in our community, our commitment, our anchor around providing exceptional value.
All right.
And we use the word value there instead of affordability for a variety of reasons. And then all of the work that we've got going on around maintaining affordability and preserving affordability is mostly captured in objective 1.4, which falls underneath priority 1. So a priority there is operational and reliability and resiliency. And the conversations that led to it living there was that fundamentally we have to be able, our customers have to be able to afford the power, and we have to have the financial resources.
Thank you. I should know that, but I'm
pretty sure I might be the only person who walks around with it all just living.
Yeah.
There's no judgment if you don't know where it exists. So with that, we'll dive into the quarterly report. So as part of our work in 2023, we identified a core set of strategic performance metrics that we monitor on a quarterly basis. And these are similar yet complementary to the metrics that you get as part of the monthly operational report for the district. I'm going to go through this section by section, so I won't spend a lot of time on this slide. I do just want to note that there's a fair amount of pink in the middle under electric system reliability, but it is the same information that you and John have previously discussed. I don't have any new information to communicate there. So we'll go section by section. Let me know if you have questions as we go. Under safeguard what matters, we are tracking our recordable incident rate, our severity rating, and preventable vehicle accidents. Recordable incident rate, as a reminder, is the number of recordable incidents, the OSHA recordable incidents and injuries, times 200,000 divided by the total working hours. It attempts to estimate how many injuries you would have per 100 employees per year, and that allows us to compare our injury rate to our peers and other companies. Last year, our incident rate was 3.7, which is down 22% from the prior year. Of particular note, the severity rating was down year over year, and that number basically it takes the number of lost working days, so the days you were on leave or reduced duty, divided by the number of injuries, to estimate kind of how bad those injuries were. And then our preventable vehicle accidents were down 12% year over year. And that's the ones that the vehicle committee determines we could have avoided if we had taken appropriate protocols. The one note I want to provide on these numbers is that because employees have up to a year to report an injury, our recordable incident rate and our severity rating can continue to increase over the course of 2025. So as we look back at 2024, the numbers aren't really set in stone until you get pretty much to the end of.
This is impressive. And you know, if we looked at a 20-year graph on these, I mean, when I remember when I first got here, 8 years ago, you just started making progress, but the data 15, 20 years ago was horrific. Our accident rate was so high. So.
You read it correctly.
It's very impressive. Thanks, everybody.
It does. The second area of focus is system reliability, and we look at this for both the electric system and the water system. I won't spend a ton of time on these numbers because I know you talked about the 2024 numbers with John at the last meeting with the operational dashboard that went through December, and the 12-month period is the same there. The one note I would give you is that the semi-5 number, which is kind of the, I don't have a laser pointer, but the 3.1% number, so that's customers experiencing multiple interruptions, it's 6 or more. That number, well up year over year, is still significantly down from where it was when we first started monitoring it in 2018. And the all-in number, which would be all outages, even the ones we consider for major event days or planned outages, is only 6.2%, which is still statistically quite low in terms of the number of customers with multiple outages. And water system reliability is our glowing green spot here.
John said that Amy was going to fix all the paint on the left side of the dress in the first quarter.
There is a team that kicked off about 3 weeks ago looking at how to better segment the electric reliability numbers to understand how to compare kind of blue sky outages year over year, which would give us insight into the outages. I won't say that we could control that, but that are more standard, not driven by extreme weather events.
Right. Yeah. Evergreen state.
Yeah. We talked about this at when we went through the quarterly report. Excuse me. We will come up with a blue sky or a non-storm reliability targets that are really, and I think controlling is a, at least a little better word, because we can do the tree trimming, we can replace the cable, we can add more equipment and reclosers and cutouts that absolutely on a blue sky day does make a difference. We just can't control the severity or the number of storms. You look at our reliability stats to date, and we look fantastic. Again, it's just we haven't had many storms,
right.
So it's too storm dependent, and we want to try to eliminate as much of that as possible and have data that actually causes us to continuously improve, and that will have an impact on how resilient our system is to storms. You just won't ever necessarily see that in the data.
Is blue sky pretty much a standard in the industry?
Yeah, non-storm.
Okay.
Some utilities, or most utilities, have a non-storm reliability data based on no storms and targets. Some actually divide the level of storms in multiple levels or layers. We could go that. I think our first order of business is to get a non-storm or blue sky target.
They do it a number of different ways across the utilities. There's not one nerdy note would be that unlike like major event days where there's an accepted calculation for how you decide whether or not something is a major event day, there is not an industry-wide shared calculation for storm versus non-storm, et cetera. Every utility does it different specific to their operations and their service territory. Financial stability, we continue to perform above board requirements and targets for current ratio and debt service coverage ratio. I won't spend a lot of time diving into those. My notes on the, or I won't spend any time diving into them unless you have questions for me. Operating ratio on the electric side, we ended the year above budget and above the 2023 number, driven mostly by the power costs issue that you're familiar with from Martin Luther King Day. Customer experience and community engagement. We continue to use the JD Power as our kind of source of truth here at the moment, as we're continuing to develop internal metrics around customer experience and satisfaction. I want to flag that I have a color error here where it says our segment rank under overall customer satisfaction went up. We're in 7th place from 11th. That should be all in green. So I automated it. I missed it when I was proofing this for you. My note on the customer satisfaction index score is that while our score went down, we did move up 4 places in the ranking of mid-sized utilities. That's because I think, as you've heard before, the entire industry is suffering from sort of a decline in scores. And so our ability to do better than our peers, even while our score is going down, speaks well of us. A bright spot here would be that our net promoter score, which is the percentage of customers that would kind of endorse us to others, minus the percent of customers that are detractors and would say bad things about us, is 10. And we jumped 10 places in that ranking, all the way up from 23rd to 13th.
Wow.
And so while the number itself isn't impressive, our movement within the industry is. And we continue to see both an increase in score and placing in our involvement in community. I do want to note that this is the Q4 results, or the end of 2024 results. And this survey was fielded in October, so it was before the bomb cyclone hit or any other economic news or anything else happening in the world. So we'll see what happens with the scores when we get them for Q1, which will be coming in March. And then my other note is my understanding from talking to Hillary Olson, who's our customer experience manager, is that JD Power is changing the way they do scoring in 2025.
Really?
Yes. They did it to us in 2019 as well, 2018 or 2019. Which means that we will have less ability to track ourselves through time because they're redoing everything again. So stay tuned.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, how do you launch these surveys?
So this one we pay through for an organization called JD Power. And if you've ever seen awards for like car makers and that type of thing, JD Power does rankings for a lot of industries. And we essentially pay them to include us and make sure that we get a big enough sample of our customers when they do their quarterly survey. And then they take all of that information in and they give us a score that basically we can compare ourselves through time, but also shows us how we rank against other utilities.
So this survey is online, or how would they do that?
Yes, it is an online survey.
And it's only in English?
I do not know that, but I can ask that.
We will find out the answer for that question.
Yeah, thinking outside the box. I mean,
yeah.
Yes, okay. Yeah, thank you.
Welcome. Okay. Moving on to employee experience, which is our final area of focus. So voluntary employee turnover. So those are the employees who leave by their own choice, and it does not include retirement. So these are people who have left to take other jobs or to stay home or to do other things. We see that number up slightly year over year, the end of 2024 versus end of 2023. But the statistician that lives in my brain wants to say, you know, 2.5 to 2.8 isn't a huge measurement. That could be one person difference. What's important here is that the graph just to its right, which looks at our overall employee turnover, which includes both voluntary departures, involuntary departures, and retirements, we continue to perform far better than our peers. They're the orange line in that graph, or the dark blue line, and better than the Puget Sound region as a whole. And then the new metrics that show up here, they're the only new metrics this quarter, are under employee experience. We fielded an annual employee, the first of our new annual employee engagement surveys last fall. We had 68% participation, and we received an overall favorability rating of 68%, an overall engagement score of 75.5%. Because we want to be the best, we're comparing ourselves to the best places to work that we have a comparison that we have access to. So while our scores are quite high and we do and should feel good about them, there's always room for growth to catch up to the best places to work in the region.
No satisfaction in second place.
No satisfaction in second place.
Well, I guess that's, is there a way to next time to provide some context to this? So are we in second place, or we're?
We don't actually get a ranking. We just get a comparison to the overall benchmark.
Okay.
Well, to me, it's like first place. Honestly, I've been here for almost a month or 2 months, and I feel so welcome. And I can see that everyone, the employees, it feels so good working here, and they speak for that. I don't need to ask, but I can perceive that. Yeah.
That's great to hear. To your point, Sid, if we're not winning, we're losing.
I'm just saying, as numbers go, the best is 76. I don't know what the average is. I don't know what the worst is. I don't know what the fourth best is.
Far below us. The average is also below.
It's just hard. It's hard to have context.
And I'm not sure. On the employee turnover, I guess I was looking at retired. Are we seeing a general trend down due to the average age of the workforce? It looks like it's going down somewhere.
We've definitely seen a leveling off. If you were to take that graph and extend it back pre-pandemic,
okay.
the percent of retirements has come down in our turnover. I don't know the answer to the question in terms of what's driving that. I do know that the average tenure here at the district has come down quite a bit in the last 5 or 6 years.
And we have through and towards the tail end of COVID, we had a significant number of retirements.
Yeah.
Though our average or the demographic, age demographic, has come down.
So that brings us to the end of the nerdiness of this morning's conversation. This is just an intentionally duplicated slide to give context. There's a lot of green on here. We've already talked about the areas of pink. The last part of what I wanted to talk about this morning is just...
Can we go back to this slide?
Of course we can.
You know, the thing about electric reliability is not because we see pink that we got to fix it so not see pink. It's really about understanding if we're making...
Yes.
An overall improvement with all the capital and expense money we spent to work on your life.
Absolutely.
And I guess that's what
is
driving my concern over making sure we have a good number, whether it's blue sky or something.
A better number so that we can really do an informed assessment.
Yeah, I mean, these numbers are important too.
Yes.
But it's hard to tell if we're making things better.
Right, it's hard to know if 1 year is due to weather and wind speeds, as you heard in the reliability presentation, or if it's driven by other opportunities for improving the value of the investments that we make. And that is what the team is focused on answering that question, is to ensure that as they look at how to segment the outages, that they don't accidentally exclude things we should be looking at or include things that we shouldn't. And so they're... Yep. There will be a real science and an art to determining what our blue sky or non-storm should be.
And to Laura's point, that CME number is one good way to, reflect that, as well as, and I think as we talked about in the reliability presentation, when you look at worst performing feeders, outage causes, those are the things that we're looking to try to trend down and trend in the right direction.
Yeah.
It just, again, there is just way too much influence on storms, from storms, the number and the severity that can impact that.
Yeah, which makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think it's also always important to note that even in a year that felt like the number is quite high for Sadie, the average interruption or number of minutes a customer was without power at 192, that still means that the power was on 99.964% of the time that you flipped the light switch, not the lights. Final part of our conversation this morning is key achievements for Q3 to Q4 of last year. I'm just going to go priority by priority for a few moments. This is clearly not an exhaustive list, and I'm not planning to dive into the detailed list at the back of it. I just always think it's worth calling out a few things that we did that feel like key milestones or achievements. So under bolster operational reliability and resiliency, which is our priority one, you heard presentations about a huge number of this, or most of these things. So the SnowSmart program grant contract, there's an update this morning on the contract for the distribution automation infrastructure contract. There was conversation about the transmission lines having been fully inspected and the fault locations as part of the annual reliability report. We, as you are well aware, are switching BPA power products at the end of this year in the fourth quarter. There was a capacity exchange transaction for power scheduling services. Please don't ask me the details because I know exactly what this slide says. That saved us $1.2 million and helped recoup some of our overspend in January last year. Not recoup it, but make up that delta. The Enterprise Risk Management Program is off to a running start, and they have identified, assessed, and prioritized strategic risks across the organization and are now working on the next steps of risk mitigation plans. There's a group that worked together led by Sarah Bond and Dennis Gao to look at budget and cost management practices. They've pulled together a huge number of recommendations. The first one was to establish sort of kind of guiding principles for us for financial management here at the district. And now they're working on identifying required training for certain positions.
My next question was, yep. If you're going to have training.
Okay. Yep, they're looking at both changes to how we do things as well as training to ensure that everybody understands the values, but then also more technical training for those who are in budget and cost management roles. And then there's been a lot of conversations about rate updates and rate changes, so I won't dive into that. Underneath evolve and enhance customer experiences, the proactive outage alert capability was implemented. That's that ability for you to sign up and say, I always want to get outage alerts. And that went live last quarter, or yeah, at the end of the year. There are new alerts in My Snowpud. So if you have registered your account, you can get text or email alerts about whether or not your payment went through, past due reminders, if you have a credit card expiring that's on auto payments. You can also now initiate a move in or a move out online, which is a new capability for us.
I have a question about that. Do we have the total customers that registered for My Snowpud?
That is a number I should know the answer.
You don't have to give me that right now, but I'm just curious. I mean, how many do we serve, and if it's a room to close that gap?
My soft recollection, and Jeff Feinberg's he might know he doesn't know the exact number.
Yeah.
It's right around 72%. Well, the number is right around 72% of our active accounts at the end of last month that have a My Snowpud registration. So that would be roughly 220,000 households.
And what are
that's the meters.
No, it's kind of at the account level.
Oh, that's
what I recall is in the past year or two, it's gone up significantly.
There's been a big push to get people to use their online access.
I wondered if people that speak different language besides English, they utilize this.
I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm wondering.
Would you like us to do some investigation and see if we can answer that question?
I don't want you waste your time, and I don't want the people waste their time, but that mean population that we serve, we must have the information, right? I mean, all the people that we serve, what group of demographics they belong or not, because sometimes it's confidential, sometimes you don't ask race and ethnicity and not those things. So sometimes you don't know. So
there must be some sensitivity to us asking those kinds of questions.
Yes.
And that's not looking for
one. No, I mean, it depends. I don't think so. Sometimes it's not, and we shouldn't ask that if it's not allowed, because it's, again, something the law doesn't.
So
yes, it's the privacy, but I'm just curious because it's Snohomish County is growing rapidly and it's so diverse versus other counties, and that's the reason that I asked. That's it, because it is a good resource, a good tool to utilize. So that is the reason that I say it. And I will like the others that they don't utilize it.
Yeah.
Should utilize that because it is, I don't know, it's helpful, you know.
So we have a lot of information about our customers that wouldn't require us to ask them that question. So if you're okay with it, we could take an ask to see if we can get some comparison of participation or usage of My Snowpud across demographic groups.
Yeah, we can take a look and see what information is available or that we can extract the information that we have now. I think that the number, I believe, is around 250,000 have signed up for the My Snowpud. And it is, there is a heavy duty campaign going on and with the CSRs and customer service on getting people to go paperless and to sign up for My Snowpud. So we should have some good information that we can share.
Thank you. I do have a comment. Given my sense that it's not a straight up issue, I mean, it will take some work. Is this a good use of our staff time?
We're not going to go any deeper than what we already have the data for. We'll bring that back and then see if there is other questions. But We're not gonna make a project out of this now. We'll see what data that we have available, and see if that potentially answers the question. And if not, then we'll let you discuss what other information that you may want if we need to go deeper.
Well, because you know, I'm always having employment background here.
Yep.
I'm always concerned about the values, and I understand what you're asking for, and it is important.
Yep.
But I'm always concerned of the overall value of staff time.
And I agree with you. I agree with you, Commissioner. Also, that's the reason I addressed it. I said, if it's going to take time, don't do it, because I'm just curious. I don't want to put the employees and utilize their hours in order to do that. So I agree with you 100%.
But you know, I think this is part of a bigger question that Commissioner Boyette from across me has brought up, and that is, how are we engaging with all our populations?
Yeah.
It's not just White Stone Pud, it's about getting information. So, you know, maybe in the future, if there's interest, maybe there's an opportunity to look at the holistically understand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's my thought.
And
each different way, because the important thing is we can connect.
Yeah.
We may not connect with the same people in the same ways, but I mean, to me, that's what's important.
The data and analytics team has worked hard for the last 18 to 24 months to build out what they call their customer 360 data set. And without knowing for certain, I do believe that we can give some high-level answers to this question by utilizing data we already have. It would just be a simple matter of cross-referencing it quickly.
Yeah, I really appreciate the sensitivity to not making extra work. Mm-hmm. But let's see what we have now, because like Laura said, the team has done extraordinary good work and all in pulling that data together in order for us to figure out appropriate ways to go attract people to move to My Snowplay app. So let's see what we have, and then we'll come back. And again, these questions are good for us to continue to consider how do we need to reach out to different populations and different segments.
So only for clarification, did you mention that we are doing this campaign, or we did this campaign today? To utilize My Snowplow.
Customer service is actively running a campaign right now.
Okay.
To encourage customers to sign up for paperless billing.
So do you think this order to invite and identify leaders in the community, they belong to different cultures, different demographics, and maybe have a meeting with them, and maybe they are going to be the ambassadors, and they communicate to the groups and say, hey, we need to utilize this, but also we can maybe, if they don't know how to do that, maybe we can model it for them and say, okay, is how you can access that, because sometimes we assume that everybody uses technology, but there's a lot of gap in illiteracy and technology and people that don't know how to do that. So if we see that this is a room of opportunity, I mean, that's something that thinking outside the box we can do. And I'm very pleased if I can help somehow, and I can send the names to you or to Allison, to the leaders in the community. They know they belong to different groups, and you can send an email and have something, a meeting or something. Thinking outside the box, and I really want to respect the time, but it's something that's really important in order that people can utilize that.
Yeah, but Commissioner, I think we have to be careful with here, because we've delegated responsibility for these kinds of things to our general manager. So I think it's fine for us to give suggestions, but I think it's really up to John and his team
Absolutely.
To figure out. And so I think results are our purview and direction and understanding, you know, what our desires are. And so I think we've shared a desire to understand how we're connected with people.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
Thank you for the clarification. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great questions. And we'll come back with some information.
Let's see. finishing up my couple of thoughts here on evolve and enhance customer experience. I believe you've talked with Peter and Christina quite a bit about Schedule 7 changes, rate schedule changes for later this spring, as well as that you've approved the extension of the commercial industrial time of day rate pilot and made the net billing rate permanent. For our priority three, which is actively help our communities thrive, the Engagement Council finalized their charter. And essentially what that's intended to do is to articulate how we will make decisions about where we're engaging in our communities and what that looks like. And they meet on a monthly basis. They're working together to identify opportunities and clear roles and responsibilities with various community organizations. We've completed the new load policy updates for loads up to 9.9 megawatts, and there's work underway to identify and determine our strategy and policy for loads greater than 10 megawatts.
This is the data center issue.
It's data centers and other large, significant large new loads. And then as a note, incorporated in the actively help our communities thrive is our objective, which is tied to supporting economic vitality in our communities. And a big part of that work is to ensure that we are connecting new meters on time and as expected. We connected approximately 5,000 new meters in 2024 and had robust interest in our apprenticeship recruitment program and have apprentices on board and working through.
Tony loves it.
We love new apprentices.
I'm into that apprenticeship.
Under Build a Sustainable Future with Our Communities, we have drafted an internal version of an environmental sustainability action plan that is focused on the impacts of our operations outside of power supply. And they're working through that process internally to get feedback and buy-in. As part of that, they have revised the charter or developed a new charter for our environmental advisory team. And that group kicked off their work last week. They will have an integral role in developing and finalizing the environmental sustainability action plan and then executing it. And finally, under culture, create the culture and capabilities needed for the future, which is a big priority with a lot of work happening underneath it. We talked briefly already about the 2024 employee engagement survey. We had a 68% response rate, which is above average. Coming out of that and based on the answers to those questions and the evaluation and analysis provided by the consultants that we worked with on that, the executive leadership team has identified fostering an accountability mindset with a clear focus on leadership accountability as what we're focused on in 2025 as a response to the concerns and feedback that we heard from employees. We've also worked to improve the job applicant experience as part of our Be an Employer of Choice and, you know, hire and retain the employees that we want to be successful in the future. We implemented SAP People Stories, which is basically a better way to see the information about our employees and have improved access to reporting. That helps us understand, for instance, who's doing what training, are we running on time for compliance training, that type of thing. The team that's leading and facilitating our enterprise project governance board held a multi-day business case training for IT project managers and functional teams intended to ensure that we all have a common understanding of how to write a good business case and the elements that go into that to help drive our project evaluation and prioritization work. And then finally, working with the executive leadership team, we've developed a new framework for the business review meeting that they do on a monthly basis that includes kind of standardized and shared division report formatting that for those core operations pieces that we have a shared responsibility for. And that reporting is then tied to their operating plans for their divisions.
So it's only linked to shared responsibility or?
I've merged a whole lot of words into that sentence. They have a shared format for reporting on things like safety and budget management and employee recruiting and retention. And then individual divisions are reporting on their work against their operating goals.
Thank you.
You're welcome. With that, I'm here to answer any other questions or concerns that you might have.
Maybe you shouldn't ask this.
I know, it's always dangerous.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you very much. And welcome to the PUD.
Thank you.
Fantastic job, Laura. Hey, that's it for our study session.
Okay, so next we have our general manager report. Report for us.
Well, that's right. That's right up. Couple things to share. In our HR and benefits, HR and our HR business operations team received the Golden Shovel Award from the DIG team, Data and Information Governance, for their exceptional efforts in keeping data secure. Our new internal job shadow program launched by promoting equal access to career development and supporting a collaborative culture. The program reflects the district's commitment to employee engagement and professional growth. And also, February is National Heart Month. Blood pressure monitors have been placed throughout the district so employees can do their own blood pressure checks. I walked by one this morning. I thought the nurse had left part of her equipment near my office, and maybe that was intentional. A couple other things my agenda. I chaired my first members representative committee meeting last week at the NERC meetings. Overall went very well. Glad to have the first one behind me, but a unique experience. Heading to Vancouver, Washington tomorrow for the NWPPA spring board meetings, and then to DC over the weekend for our APPA executive committee and board meetings, and then our Hill visits with you next week with the delegation. And that's it. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions on John's report?
I don't know.
You know, I think if you walk by the blood pressure monitor, yeah. I don't think it actually monitors anything.
If it did, it was pretty low.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Next, item 5, items for individual consideration. 5A, consideration of resolution authorizing the chief customer officer, customer energy services of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute amendment number 4 to the agreement 2019-20 low income weatherization and energy savings agreement with Snohomish County and ratifying the increase in incentives for certain energy efficiency measures. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Jeff Feinberg is available to answer any questions. I'll first ask if there's any comments from the public regarding the resolution. If so, please raise your hand. I don't see any hands up. Are there any questions or comments, Commissioner?
I don't have any. Is there any federal money that flows to the state for these programs?
Hi, Jeff Nyberg, Senior Manager, Energy Services, and yes, this is a federal weatherization program that goes to the state, and then they use demographics to send it to the county, and then we co-fund it as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
With any other questions, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carried unanimously. Next, 5B, consideration of resolution authorizing the manager real estate services to execute all necessary documents to purchase certain real property, tax parcel number 003944065015000, with an address of 8505 172nd Street Northwest, Stanwood, Washington. I'll call for a motion.
I will
have to move on. Green Barnes is available to answer any questions regarding the resolution. Are there any comments from the public regarding this resolution? Please raise your hand.
What we've done is at our last meeting on February the 4th.
Any questions? Thank you. Okay, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried unanimously. Next is Commission Business 6A, Commission Reports. Is there any reports, Commissioners?
Well, I had the opportunity to participate for the first time, and I'm new with the acronyms, okay? BBC and PINA meeting held in Portland.
That's
okay. And I was there, and it is a very interesting time to learn and to be able to connect with other public utilities, and has a lot I still like, yes, that in my brain. I'm not ready yet. I took a lot of notes, but I'm very pleased to be there, and I'm looking forward to provide value insights in the future and enhance the work. So very nice to be there with my colleague, Commissioner Logan, too, and other employees there. So that was very nice.
It's an excellent opportunity to really, for the game, more information, not only regionally, but nationally.
And then it's more exciting every year since I've been here.
The PPC meeting.
And interesting, presentation on artificial intelligence and how utilities are able to do things like streamline writing a job description draft in like 5 minutes, close to 4 hours.
Yeah, I've even played around with it a little bit. I think our team is getting nervous. The more I play around with it,
sure.
it is powerful. It's amazing.
Next, we have our commissioner event calendar. Are there any changes to the event calendar? Page 16 of our packet.
I have a question. So my understanding is that we collaborate in partnership with the Chamber of Commerce, right? So I'm aware that Linwood Chamber of Commerce, they meet tomorrow. And I don't know if, I mean, we...
I believe that we sent you an email and so I didn't hear back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
we can still register you if you'd like to go. Just get in contact with Morgan.
Okay, I will get in contact with. Thank you.
Yes, I think that's some work that's being done. And the clerk staff is also looking for opportunities. I do have a question on that. Do we need to become a member of those office chambers?
We have become members. They engage my council with all of them. I just want to clarify, too, that when there's council events, the board is only invited if it's something elected official or something that would relate to the PUD. A lot of it, if it's stuff like that has nothing to do at all with what we do or other electeds aren't there, we won't send an invite because there's many events that go on.
You're talking about economic alliance?
She was talking chambers.
Oh, chambers.
No, the economic alliance as well, same situation. Okay. A lot of it's not relevant to what we do.
We do training.
Yeah.
Okay. So any changes to the event calendar other than sound like you're gonna be registered for the Linwood Chamber?
Yes.
If it's a regular meeting. If
it's a regular meeting, yes. I don't know. I'm new, so I have no idea when and what events we are able to attend or not.
Okay. Next is item 6C, consideration of resolution approving the second amendment to amended employment agreement between Public Utility District Number 1 of Commerce County and John A. Harlow. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the resolution? Please raise your hand. Any questions or comments from the commissioners?
I have none either.
No, just to say this is just a small thing to make sure that there's just an automatic adjustment to
taken care of.
But
I've already taken care of that with finance. They'll be monitoring it.
To make sure that the travel allowance is adjusted consideration with the federal allowance. I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Next, our governance planning calendar, item 7. Are there any changes to the planning calendar? Go ahead. Yeah. Page 135.
Some question clarification. On the pending items, one through page 135, governance policy review. I thought that had already been done.
The one that we're scheduling for March 13th is more a policy training. And then after we do that, we go a couple of months and kind of get going with that. Then we'll do a review with any modifications and do a review.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments or changes to the governance planning calendar?
I haven't.
Is there any further business to come before the board today? It is now 10:40 a.m. and the board will recess into executive session to discuss computer and telecommunications security risk assessments under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It's anticipated this next session will last approximately 60 minutes and conclude at, we're going to take a 10-minute break before we start. So it will conclude at 11:50. The commission does not expect further action on the executive session, and we'll adjourn the regular meeting on the conclusion. I'm repeating my announcement. At 11:49, the executive session was extended for approximately 8 minutes, and we'll conclude at 11:57.